Hello and welcome to the Torah Simcha Parsha with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Aviva Orlean and today we will be studying Parshas Pinchas. We begin our Parsha with the aftermath of the sin of Baal Pa'ar, which we read about in last week's Parsha, where the people were lured by Midian to engage in acts of zanus, immoral acts with the women of Moab as well as Midian, and these acts were done as a way to entice them to serve this very base type of Avodah Zarah of the Baal Pa'ar. And in last week's Parsha, we saw the audacious display. The names are not mentioned in that Parsha, but they are mentioned in this week's Parsha. The display of Zimri, the Nasi from the tribe of Shimon, who consorted publicly in front of everybody with Cozbi, the princess from Midian. Hashem became angry. A plague broke out. 24,000 people died. Pinchas, understanding that in a very specific moment, under very specific parameters, he can act, kana'im pogimbo, he can act with zealousness, and he took matters into his own hands without due process, and he killed Zimri and Cozbi, thus stopping the plague. The people were in a frenzied, almost intoxicated state, and Pinchas acted courageously, literally risking his life because people could have, they could have taken retribution on him, and he is able to shock the people back to their senses. Zealousness in this type of intense manner, while rewarded when it came to Pinchas, is not something, obviously, that we should necessarily use as a model. Do not try this at home. But Pinchas's motivations were razor sharp and pure. There were no ulterior motives. There was no personal bias and consideration. And therefore, he was rewarded. Says the Torah, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen heshivas chamasi me'al b'nei Yisrael bekano es kinasi bitocham. Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron HaKohen, turned back my wrath from upon b'nei Yisrael when he zealously took upon my vengeance among b'nei Yisrael. Says Hashem, l'chein amor hinanino sein lo es brisi shalom. I am going to give him this everlasting covenant of peace. V'hayesal lo ulzaro acharov bris Kahunas Olam, and he is going to be given the gift of Kahuna. At this point, even though he was a grandson of Aaron, the Kahuna was not formally given to him. And here is where he is given this Kahuna because of this act. This Brisi Shalom, as the Torah says, is this Kahuna. And there are other ways to understand what is this Brisi Shalom? What is this Bris Shalom? It's curious. It's a very curious reward, actually, because even if he was in the right, but the idea of Shalom, of this everlasting peace, or even the reward of Kahuna, which is identified with the being peaceful amongst the people, being a representative of the people, it just seems to be a very odd reward that he is associated with Shalom when he acted in a violent way, even though it was justified. The Netziv gives a very fascinating explanation from a psychological and emotional perspective. The peace that was given to Pinchas is this sense of serenity and protection from the psychological impact and emotional turmoil that could occur as a result of engaging in such a violent act of suddenly stabbing two people in such a public manner. Because really, a person's entire essence changes based on his act, right? Ha'adam nif'al kafi pu'ulosav. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving Pinchas safeguards to protect him from being hardened. Think of hardened soldiers, right? What happens when they come back from combat? Their entire essence changes. So this was a safeguard to Pinchas that his essence wouldn't change as a result of acting in this way. Very fascinating idea. And the Emek Davar, the Netziv, also relates this to the other mitzvos, which may seem like violent, but the Torah gives this extra protection. Really, the Torah is a Torah's chesed. So by definition, anything that you do within the constraints of the Torah really should not really change who we are if it is done within the confines of the Torah. And he points out that when it comes to the Ir Nidachas, where the Torah commands the people to wipe out an entire city of idolaters, a wayward city, under very, very specific parameters and circumstances, obviously. But the Torah promises that the ones that carry out this command of wiping out an entire city, the Torah says, V'nasan l'cha rachamim v'richamcha, this Hashem will give you rachamim and Hashem will have mercy on you. And this double lashon of rachamim and v'richamcha is this idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu safeguards those people so that they do not become hardened after committing such an act. So Pinchas is given this reward of this bris shalom from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then we move from this incident to the Torah's command of Tziror es HaMidyanim. Our attitude has changed towards the Midyanim, and this was a declaration that the Midyanim are our official enemies because of their role in luring and entrapping Klal Yisrael to sin in this very, very dangerous way, where the whole fabric of the family purity is at stake, which, as we know, is so related to the very existence of Klal Yisrael. Moshe is then told to count the people. The Levim would be counted separately, very similar to the beginning of our Sefer, right? Remember, this was the Sefer HaPekudim, the Book of Numbers, right? So the first census happened at the beginning of our Sefer, where Bnei Yisrael were poised to enter the land. Unfortunately, history took a different trajectory, but now they are poised to enter the land once again. It's like take two, and now they are now they have to be counted. And certainly, following the aftermath of 24,000 people dying, this census has significance. And of course, they are about to enter Eretz Yisrael. They will be dividing up the land based on their population. They're going to be engaging in warfare. So they have to be counted for very practical reasons, for military reasons. And the census takes place. And here as well, just as in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, the focus is on the family unit. When the details are provided, they are done so within the context of each family. For example, for the tribe of Reuven Bechor Yisrael, Bnei Reuven Chanoch, Mishpachas HaChanochi. So it's speaking about the family unit. There's also very interesting departure here, and that is that the Yalkut Shimoni points out that the names of the families are bracketed with a yud and a hey representing Hashem's names, HaChanochi, HaChetzroni, and so on. And what this does is, particularly after the base immorality that was displayed by Bnei Yisrael, the names of the families that are bracketed with the yud and the hey, yud and hey representing, of course, Hashem's name, this is testimony to the fact, it's attesting to the purity and the integrity of the family unit. Particularly after having engaged in such immoral act, there was questions about the overall integrity and the morality of the people. After all, they had been enslaved, the Egyptians were in charge of every single aspect of their lives. Who's to say that the Egyptians didn't take advantage of the women? And who's to say that there isn't questions about the paternity? But the family names that are bracketed with the yud and the hey is a testimony to the fact that there is no question about the paternity and the morality and the integrity of that family unit. This census also highlights the major transition, that this was a new generation and those people that had died out in the Midbar were not counted in this census. The Torah makes specific mention of this. Ube'ele lo haya ish mipekudei Moshe v'Aaron ha'Kohen. And in this census there, it was not the same people that were counted with the census of Moshe and Aaron, asher pakdu es b'nei Yisrael b'midbar Sinai. Ki amar Hashem lahem mos Yamusu Bamidbar, because Hashem had declared that those people that were involved in Chet Meraglin would indeed die out in the Midbar. Velo nosar mehem ish, there was nobody left, ki im Kalev ben Yefuna v'Yehoshua ben Nun, the only ones that were left were Kalev and Yehoshua, who of course were not part of the negativity of the 12 Meraglim. And this census leads us to the claims of Benos Tzlafchad, the daughters of Tzlafchad, very, very intelligent and bold women. The laws of inheritance, of the division of the land and keeping the land within the family states, that the land is passed down via the sons. And the daughters of Tzlafchad approached Moshe with a claim that since their father had died in the desert, they were not part of the rebellion of Korach, he left no sons, and therefore they would be left out of owning a portion, that their family would not really have a portion in Eretz Yisrael. And they say, Lama yigara shem avinu mitoch mishpachto? Why should the name of our father be detracted from amongst his family because he had no sons? They very passionately state their case, Tanalanu achuza betoch achei avinu. Please give us an inheritance from amongst our father's brothers. Now this pasuk, Lama yigara shem avinu, has echoes to another time in history, 38 years prior, in Parshas Baaloscha, where there were also a group of people who wanted to partake of a mitzvah that they felt that they would be losing out on, and that was where the mitzvah of the Pesach Sheni came about. In the second year after leaving Mitzrayim, as we recall, the people who were did not want to be denied the opportunity of partaking in the Korban Pesach, and therefore they say, Anachnu tmeim lenefesh adam, lama nigara lebilti hikriv es Korban Hashem. The parallel, of course, is the passion and the desire to perform the will of God. With the Pesach Sheni, this passion facilitated a halacha that was then taught. And here with the Benos Tzlafchad, a halacha would be taught as well, relating to the laws of inheritance. Benos Tzlafchad had this passion for the land. There were no ulterior motives. They truly desired a portion in Eretz Chemda Tova Urechava. Furthermore, as Rashi explains on the Psukim dealing with the census, where we alluded to the fact that the names that the men who were involved in Chet Meraglim, those people died in the Midbar. He explains over there, and he connects the census to this incident of Benos Tzlafchad. This Benos Tzlafchad really represent the overall tone of the women in general, who, as we have said, had a passion and desire for Eretz Yisrael. There were no words of disdain. There was no pessimism. There was no rejection of the land. They were absolutely not part of the Chet Meraglim. And therefore, unlike the men from the age of 20 and up who died in the Midbar, the women from that generation, as well as the new generation, were able to enter the land. And says Rashi, Al hanashim lo nigzera gezeras hamaraglim, lefi shehem mechavavos es haaretz. So the women were not part of that gezera of not inheriting the land, because they loved the land. The men on the one hand said, Nitna rosh v'nashuva, let's return back to Mitzrayim, we don't want the land. And the women, as represented by the Benos Tzlafchad, said, Tana lanu achuza, we indeed want a portion of the land. And obviously a very timely message, as we are approaching Tisha B'Av, the precursor of which was Chet Meraglim, whose attitude displayed a disregard for Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, at this time, we should emulate the Benos Tzlafchad and the women of Dor HaMidbar by displaying a positive attitude and a love for the land. At this point, Moshe asks Hashem what the halacha is. And Hashem affirms and endorses their request and says, Kain Benos Tzlafchad Dovros, they are speaking correctly. Nason titein lahem achuzas nachala, give them a portion of the land. Their passion led them to action. It led them to take initiative to ask for something that was confusing to them. I think that many times in life, we also have questions. Things don't sit well. We're confused. And the question is, do we let it fester so that it develops into an unhealthy frustration? Or do we perhaps make respectful inquiries? The Benos Tzlafchad approached Moshe because there was something that didn't sit well with them, and they presented Moshe with a very cogent and respectful argument. Maybe the halacha would be in their favor, maybe it wouldn't, but they never would have known would they not have taken that initiative and broached the subject. An appropriate lesson, I think, on this platform of the OU Women's Initiative. So the Benos Tzlafchad will have a portion and have the opportunity to enter the land. The people of that generation will enter the land. The women of both the original and the new generation will merit to live in the land. But alas, Moshe Rabbeinu will not.
He is told again by Hashem, Ure'es ha'aretz asher nasati levinei Yisrael, v'ra'isa osav v'ne'esavta el amecha, gam ata. Go and look at this land, but you can see it, but you will not be able to enter the land because you will pass on. Ka'asher ne'esaf Aaron achicha, just as Aaron, your brother, died. Moshe puts his own pain aside, however, and wants to ensure that his charges, his people, are placed in capable hands. And he implores Hashem, Yifkod Hashem Elokei HaRuchos L'chol Basar Ish Al Ha'eda. Hashem should appoint somebody to in charge of the congregation. Asher Yetzei Lefneim V'Asher Yavo Lefneim V'Asher Yotzeim V'Asher Yivieim. Someone that will go out from before them, come in, will take them out and bring them back. V'lo Tiye Adas Hashem Katzon Asher Ein Lahem Roa. So that they should not be a group of people, like a group of sheep that does not have a shepherd. Listen to that beautiful language that Moshe uses, Katzon Asher Ein Lahem Roa. Moshe, the consummate leader who began his career as a shepherd himself, invokes the imagery of his pastime, during which time we know his sensitivity and attention to his charges, his sheep, according to the Medrash, were one of the many characteristics that made him well suited for his role as leader. Here, too, he continues to see himself as the ultimate shepherd and nurturer, and wants his successor to view himself like this as well. Hashem names Yehoshua, his trusted attendant, as his successor. The Torah then goes on to list the daily and monthly sacrifices, as well as the list of the Shalosh Regalim, Yom Kippur, and Rosh Hashanah, and their accompanying karbanos. What stands out here towards the end of our parsha really is Moshe's desire to facilitate a peaceful transfer of power for the people. And within this request, we see some of the characteristics that Moshe highlights, some characteristics that he sees as important to have in a leader. The next era would not just be a transfer of leadership, but there would be a complete paradigm shift. The people would be different. The setting would be different. Their activities would be different. The focus would be different. Moving from a miraculous to a natural existence, who would be able to lead them? Rashi brings the Midrash that only heightens our sense of melancholy at this transition, that Moshe thought one of his sons would succeed him, but this was not to be. Moshe then immediately shifts gears and makes this request of Hashem, if not my sons, then please Hashem, appoint the appropriate leader. And first he says, Yifkod Hashem Elokei HaRuchos, just as Hashem knows every person's personality, Elokei HaRuchos, so should the leader be in tune with the people and be able to relate to them on a personal level. Asher Yetzei Lefneim V'Asher Yavo Lefneim, someone that will go out and come in, V'Asher Yetzeim V'Asher Yivieim. This refers to someone who is skilled in warfare, but will also not just sit back and watch it all happen, but actively get involved and lead the people into battle, should it be necessary. Furthermore, this addresses the fact that while a leader should indeed be in tune with the needs and the individual perspectives of each person within the klal, that he should be able to sense the tone and the pulse of everyone, this should be tempered with asher yotzeim v'asher yivieim, that he should take them out and bring them in, meaning that he should not be afraid to lead and not be swayed by pressure despite his sensitivity to each and every one of them. A true leader has patience, but that patience should not be mistaken for weakness. And who is chosen? We just read of, could it be Pinchas? Pinchas, we saw, had some sort of leadership quality. He took initiative, he took a stand, he acted courageously and stepped up where there was a need. But no, he's not chosen. Says the Kutzker Rebbe, because Pinchas had this midah of zealousness, and while perhaps necessary at specific moments of time, this zealousness was not a characteristic that was conducive to a leadership role. That was something that was too intense to be a leader. For that role, Yehoshua ben Nun was chosen. Yehoshua ben Nun, bin, says the Ramban, back in Shemos, from the Lashon of Bina. He had a keen insight and perception. And who is Yehoshua? We first met him in Shemos 40 years earlier when he is involved with the war in Amalek at the behest of Moshe. And again at Mamad Har Sinai, Vayakam Moshe v'Yehoshua Misharso, Moshe and Yehoshua, his attendant, Vayal Moshe El Har Elokim, and Moshe as Moshe went up to Har Sinai. Yehoshua faithfully follows Moshe, but only till the edge, as much as he possibly can, says Rashi. And after Chet HaEgel, we see that Yehoshua is referred to as his trusted attendant as well. Umesharso Yehoshua bin Nun lo yamish mitocha ohel. Yehoshua would not budge from the ohel. He was steadfastly serving Moshe Rabbeinu as he was in his tent. Na'ar, says the Ramban, implies a sense of humility and a sense of duty. And of course, Yehoshua was noted as one of the 12 spies who did not take part in the negativity that the rest of the Meraglim displayed. The Medrash paints a picture of the consummate attendant of Moshe, where he would arrange the stools and the mats for the people to learn from Moshe. This points to his desire to facilitate Moshe's strength of giving over his Torah learning. It points to his desire to facilitate scholarship within the Jewish people. A Mesharis is concerned with facilitating the development of the person he serves. He has an outward focus, which makes him the perfect candidate to be a leader to facilitate the growth of the masses. A true leader does not have his eye on the prize. He's not thinking, when will I be the leader? A true leader is somebody that's not even thinking of leadership. A true leader is somebody that develops in a very quiet, in a very subtle type of way. And Yehoshua, as the attendant to Moshe, had the perfect ingredients that are necessary in a leader. Rav Soloveitchik points out that Moshe was told to, one, give smicha, the precursor of smicha, v'yismochas yadav alav v'yitzavehu, the smicha. And then the next piece was, v'nasata mehodcha alav l'man yishma kol adas b'nei Yisrael, put your hand and give some of your hod, give some of your glory over to him. So there was smicha, which was the mesorah of halacha, says Rav Soloveitchik, and there was hod, which represented the general tone and the passion that went into the Torah. It's a twofold mesorah, says Rav Soloveitchik. It's the mesorah haseichel, the intellectual transmission and the traditions, and the mesorah halev, the emotion that goes into it, the behavior, how one behaves. And as Moshe's trusted attendant, this is what Yehoshua absorbed from Moshe. The Gemara in Bava Basra notes the relationship between Moshe and Yehoshua. Pnei Moshe kipnei chama upnei Yehoshua kipnei levana. That Moshe's face was like the light of the sun, and Yehoshua's was like the light of the moon, representing Yehoshua's ability to absorb from Moshe, like the moon absorbs the light of the sun, watching, observing, serving, and learning from a great person's every move. This is what creates the next generation of leaders. It's not just about the scholarship, but it's about the mode of behavior with every detail. But that sun, Moshe Rabbeinu, was setting, which signals the end of an era. The moon will now illuminate that night. And while the light of the moon is less intense than the sun, the light of the moon, it allows perception of things in a different environment. Sun was setting, Moshe would depart from the people, but the moon, Yehoshua, appeared. Yehoshua that reflected everything that he absorbed from Moshe, and he would then pass it on to the people. As we know, change is hard. We all go through periods of our lives where we need to shift our focus, our attitudes, and be receptive to new ideas and approaches as to how to address our spiritual development. Each generation has its own set of challenges. Paradigm shifts and changes are difficult. However, being receptive to those changes and the needs to address our goals perhaps in a different way is what allows us to tolerate those changes and to grow with those changes. Thank you for studying together with the OU Women's Initiative.